I'm Brian Curtis.
And I'm Wendy Ring. Welcome to Cool Solutions, bringing you stories of climate action from the bottom up.
Okay, we're not going to lie. June 2022 was a terrible month for climate. With Joe Manchin holding back climate legislation in Congress and the Supreme Court hogtying the EPA, it would be easy to just throw up our hands.
Or just throw up. But hold on to whatever you were going to throw and take a deep breath. Remember that the greenhouse gas reduction targets we've been aiming for aren't cliffs. They're points on a slope. And whether we meet those goals or not, the more we lower emissions, the less sucky the future will be.
There may be a cliff lurking out there somewhere, but it's not where we're at now.
Where we're at feels kind of familiar, though. Like when we started Cool Solutions back in 2018. We needed stories about climate action from the bottom up then, because if anything was going to happen, it wasn't going to come from Washington, D.C. Now, I don't know if I'm having deja vu or a PTSD flashback, but I do know that when federal action is blocked, there's still plenty we can do. We talked with climate activists on and around the date of the Supreme Court decision about one path that's still open.
Once there was a young woman who wanted to spend her life working on solving the climate crisis. She thought, all we need is lots of clean energy. So she went to Stanford, graduated with a master's degree in environmental and atmospheric engineering, and went to work in the solar industry.
I was working for a utility-scale solar developer. At the time, it was the largest solar developer in the United States.
That's Caroline Spears.
My job was to look at all the projects that we wanted to build over the next couple of years and see which projects make sense and which don't and why. I noticed something. We were building 30 to 60 projects in Massachusetts in the next 5 years. We were building zero in the state of Arizona. And you don't ever have to have been to Arizona or Massachusetts to know one of those places is a lot sunnier than the other one.
If you look at a map of solar potential, Arizona is red like an angry sunburn, and Massachusetts isn't even tan. Hailed by one former governor as the Saudi Arabia of solar, Arizona started out as a leader with some of the best solar incentives in the country. By 2012, they had the highest installed solar per capita in the United States. But then the clouds rolled in. In 2013, the state's utility commission started cutting those incentives.
In 2016, they eliminated net metering, which had paid solar customers for extra energy at retail rates.
Massachusetts, on the other hand, has net metering and a host of other incentives. They also have one of the oldest renewable portfolio standards in the country, which has required utilities to provide a steadily increasing percentage of renewable energy. This requirement, which began in 1997, just passed 50% this year. So you can be the Saudi Arabia of solar in terms of potential, but if you're the West Virginia of solar in politics, you're going nowhere.
That's what I started realizing. State and local policy was the thing that enabled us to actually build solar projects or not.
So Carolyn started volunteering to help pro-solar state and local candidates get elected.
Nathaniel Stinnett of the Environmental Voter Project agrees that these state and local races are important, especially now.
We spend so much time focused on Congress or Senate or the Supreme Court or the president that we often don't realize that the governor's mansions and the state legislatures and city hall can also really, really move the dial a lot on climate policy. It is a catastrophe that our federal government is not more aggressively leading on climate. But we can't let that blind us to the extraordinary opportunities at the state and local level. States regulate utilities and they build public transit and clean energy infrastructure and they have taxing power. I mean, California, fifth largest economy in the entire world, just passed a plastic reduction law that'll prevent nearly 23 million tons of plastic waste from being generated. New York State, the 10th largest economy in the world, just passed a green amendment to their state constitution, giving each individual New Yorker a constitutional right to clean air, clean water, and a healthful environment. These are enormous policy opportunities. And you have mayors making bus fare free and changing building codes. These are all enormously important policy levers, but perhaps more important, the political opportunities are so, so big.
For one thing, the opportunity to win. Turnout in local elections is beyond low. It's abysmal. Researchers at Portland State University analyzed 23 million voting records to understand who votes in municipal elections and who stays home. The average turnout was less than 15%, and in some cities, it was in the single digits.
And we can shake our heads at that, but let's also recognize what an extraordinary political opportunity that is, because that means you have this teeny tiny denominator of overall turnout deciding who the next mayor is going to be. And that means if you can bump turnout 200, 300, 400 people, you could change a significant amount of climate and environmental policymaking. And that's why local elections in particular are this extraordinary opportunity. It's the easiest way to make an outsized difference.
One thing I've observed in 4 years of reporting on climate solutions is that cities and states are the proving grounds for policies that spread, first laterally, then vertically. It's the backroads route to federal policy adoption because it's hard to argue against something that's working. But in order to make that happen, candidates need a climate policy agenda. And Caroline found they don't come ready-made.
So I kind of thought when you run for office, people show up at your door and say, hey, thanks for running for office. Here's everything you need to know on all these different issues. And turns out, to a large extent, that doesn't really happen. How are you supposed to get up to speed on every single complex, large issue facing America in such a short period of time? It's really hard.
So while Nathaniel's Environmental Voter Project was getting people to vote in state and local elections, Caroline was helping state and local candidates develop climate plans so they could tell these voters what they planned to do.
She got so many requests from candidates, she had to quit her day job and hire staff. So she formed a nonprofit called the Climate Cabinet.
The cabinet provides state and local candidates what Caroline calls holistic climate support.
We help folks develop and think through a climate plan and messaging and talking points. If opponents are running attack ads on energy or climate, we help them. If they're thinking about how to craft their message specific to their district, we support them with that. They're wondering, hey, what does polling look like? Or, hey, what should my comments be about a Supreme Court decision? How does this affect my race? We can support them with that as well. We have weekly office hours for any candidate to come through.
They're supporting a slate of state and local climate candidates from all over the country, running for offices ranging from the Missouri State Legislature to the Tallahassee City Council.
Every race is some obscure race that doesn't hit the national news, but they're critically important for climate. If you go to climateslate.com, you can see the candidates that we're supporting. If you feel like you know someone who's running for office who is great on climate, it isn't on there, there's a contact us button on that website. Reach out. We'd love to hear and keep adding great climate champions to our slate.
So other than referrals, how do you decide who gets to be on your climate slate? There's elections going on all over the place, and you have a staff of, what, 10?
If it's anything like our local ballots, there's a bunch of people I've never heard of running for offices that I don't even know what they do.
Yeah, right? There's so many people. And actually, you're not alone, because in America, we elect 500,000 people to public office. 500,000 people every cycle.
How does the Climate Cabinet winnow through all those candidates?
Software engineering and data science. We have the largest database of local climate action in the country. I really view the data science that we do as our only effective way of scaling, because we don't have the resources that the Koch network does. We don't have the resources of some of the largest polluters in the country. You know what also resource we have? A bunch of incredible local organizations who are showing up and doing the work every single day. We never go into a race without checking with local organizations first, because they know what's on the ground. They're a critical piece of the puzzle too. We essentially look at what is the likelihood of them winning their election, and then if they win, what's their authority on climate? In 2,000 cities across America, they elect a mayor who directly signs energy contracts. So some mayor seats across the country are much more impactful on climate than others, simply because the mayor in that city has the ability to actually sign coal contracts or sign solar contracts. That's the type of stuff we look for. We scrape massive climate data sets and we scrape massive governance data sets. And we overlap those and say, hey, who has a lot of authority on climate and who is in that office currently and how are they voting? So we'll find folks who vote incredibly well on climate. We're super vulnerable. And we're like, these people are our climate champions. We have to support them. They have to stay in office. That's one type of person who makes the slate. Another type of person is incredibly vulnerable politically, and they vote terribly on climate. We have folks running who are in flippable races this year who have 15% climate scores, which literally means they vote anti-climate 85% of the time. When we say anti-climate, sometimes there's a bill that comes up that says, hey, should we install an air pollution monitoring station just to see if the air pollution is bad here? And they'll say, no, no monitoring of air pollution. Hey, should we have a study to see how electric vehicles are going to impact our grid? And they'll say, no, I don't want a study to see how electric vehicles could get integrated. I mean, these are the types of bills people are voting no on. So it's really states that are kind of on the balance of, we don't have a pro-climate majority yet, but we could get one this year or in the next couple of years. States that are really on the tipping point, and states that are like maybe a step back from the tipping point of a pro-climate majority, and do everything we can to push states and cities over the line. So that's what we really look for, is, okay, what's the climate impact if we get a pro-climate majority in this chamber? And then how far are we away? And those are the two things we look at.
Here are a few of their success stories.
Columbia, Missouri is a beautiful college town. Unlike most cities in America, they directly control their own utility. And they own some of the largest coal plants in the Midwest. So we saw that and we said, all right, who's running? And there's some great climate champions who are running for office there. So we got involved and we won those races, city council, mayoral race. And that means that we now have pro-climate people leading the city who now have the power to say, hey, let's build a local economy focused on clean energy and clean energy jobs instead of relying on out-of-state coal power. So that's one example of a race that happened a few months ago. Let me talk about two people we supported in 2020. So the first person is Texas State Representative Erin Sweener. She flipped a Trump district and then was in a really vulnerable spot in 2020. She votes pro-climate 100% of the time. She's holding on to a Trump seat. And she knows how to use the rules of the Texas State Legislature to block really bad climate bills. And that's what we love about her. So we got involved in that race. She wins that election. And then she immediately went on and started the climate caucus in the Texas State Legislature. And then this last session, she waited until 11:59 p.m., 1 minute remaining on the legislative clock, raised a point of order at the last minute to kill an anti-electrification bill. So that's what I mean. She uses the rules of the state ledge very effectively to get the job done. Second story from 2020. This is the biggest climate matchup in the Wisconsin State Legislature of 2020. You have Jim Ott, the incumbent, who is the chief climate denier in the entire Wisconsin legislature. He's a former weatherman, and he had a climate change is fake conspiracy newsletter. His opponent that cycle was Deb Andraka, an environmental lawyer and a solar advocate. So this is our biggest kind of climate matchup of the year. Really tough district, but Deb Andraka pulled it out, and she's currently sits in the Wisconsin State Legislature. This year, we so far have won 9 out of our 13 races. We're going to get involved in about 40 to 50 races total for the year.
Everyone loves a winner, but even when climate candidates lose, Nathaniel says those state and local races can still build the political power of the climate movement. I know that seems counterintuitive, but before he started the Environmental Voter Project, Nathaniel was a political strategist for mayoral and congressional campaigns. Frustrated by the lack of political will for climate action, he did what everyone who wants to sell something does these days. He set some computers searching through all our personal data and discovered that the climate movement's political power has been deliberately and preemptively sapped.
For decades, the environmental movement has been largely apolitical. It's been people talking about changing what they eat, changing how they get to work, changing the electricity they consume, recycling, all of which are important, but they're all also oddly apolitical, right? Like you would never hear someone who cares about gun rights or reproductive rights talk that way. And this was by design. This was a very explicit, well-funded PR campaign by the fossil fuel industry that was essentially trying to convince us, hey, don't look at that coal-fired power plant over here. It's all your fault for buying a plastic water bottle, which is, of course, insane. But it was very effective at making us think that we as individuals are solely responsible for these enormous systemic environmental problems.
One result of fossil fuel companies' successful campaign to distract us is that people who rank climate as a top priority vote less often than the average citizen, effectively disenfranchising themselves.
Politicians don't care about what non-voters think. They only care about what voters think. And that might sound cynical, but
When you understand at a deeper level how campaigns are run, it starts to make sense. The absolute building block of all modern campaigns and even policymaking is this. Who you vote for is secret, but whether you actually show up for a local, state, or federal election, that's public record. And so the first thing any politician does is they look at public voter files to see who is likely to show up in the election they care about. And surprise, surprise, those are the people who politicians care about. They care about the voters, not the non-voters. And they literally know who those people are by name and street address. There are tens of millions of people who care about climate and the environment in the United States. But they are disproportionately not voting.
In the dog-eat-dog world of politics, my apologies to dogs, voter turnout trumps public opinion. Take gun control, for example.
Large, large majorities of Americans support a whole host of gun control measures. But gun rights activists end up wielding just as much or more political power, not because there are more of them, there are actually less of them, but because they show up whenever there's an election.
If your problem is a lack of political power, don't sit on the sidelines during election day, because that just means you are going to have less political power. Now, is that a nice thing to hear? Is that like a really sexy, compelling bumper sticker? Like, no, of course it isn't. But it's true.
Well, some states synchronize the little elections with the big ones. Others don't. And that means more opportunities to flex and strengthen pro-climate political muscle.
In places like Georgia, where if you don't get 50% of the vote, you go to a runoff, I mean, there are some odd years where the average Georgian can have 8 different elections. Last year, odd year election, we were active in 17 states in 381 different elections. And sure enough, the cumulative impact of multi-election interventions up and down the ballot is so much greater than just parachuting in every 2 years.
Because it's a self-reinforcing process.
If we at the Environmental Voter Project get a non-voter to vote, even in some weird low turnout city council primary, well, it only takes about 2 months for the record of them having voted to show up in public voter files. And then anybody who is running for anything in that state starts pestering the you-know-what out of that person. And so that's the other reason why we're seeing these great cumulative results. It's not necessarily because we're doing anything special. It's almost because we've blown an air horn and told all the other campaigns, hey, look, there's a new voter here, guys, go and get them. And they do.
So voting in state and local elections, even if you lose,
even if you write your dog's name in on the ballot,
is important because it builds the political power of the climate movement. Now, going back to Caroline at the Climate Cabinet, this year, their story comes full circle.
Two candidates I'm so excited about are running for the Arizona Corporation Commission.
That's the same body whose solar chilling policies inspired her to work on state and local elections.
We do not yet have a pro-climate majority on the Arizona Corporation Commission. That's why we're supporting Sandra Kennedy, who's an existing commissioner. And we're also supporting someone who's running for the first time.
I'm Lauren Cuby. I am a Tempe council member until 4 o'clock tonight. And I also work at Arizona State University's Global Futures Lab. And I am running for the Arizona Corporation Commission.
Lauren's been involved in politics all her life.
You might say she's a blue diaper baby.
JFK in 1958 walked into the volunteer office in Holbrook, Massachusetts. It was just my parents and myself. I was 8 months old. He didn't come with an entourage. He was just suddenly there, you know, the candidate. He said, I miss my baby Caroline so much on the campaign trail. Can I hold your baby? And he held me for like 40 minutes. And my family used to joke and say, it imprinted me.
She volunteered for George McGovern's presidential campaign in 1972 and just kept going.
Every 2 years or every 4 years, I'd get involved. And then when Bush v. Gore happened, I thought, I have to do this every day. And I became the leader of the party in my town and worked on a lot of campaigns. And I was always like the staffer, though, working for other people.
She finally ran herself for the Tempe City Council at the age of 56.
I knocked on 14,000 doors myself, and I ran on a sustainability platform. And people said I was crazy that you had to talk about potholes and public safety, but I didn't. I talked about sustainability and I talked about equity, and I got elected. We've accomplished quite a lot in the past 8 years.
Here's what she's most proud of.
2 climate action plans, 100% renewable energy goal for our city, equal pay for equal work. We have an environmental justice and equity position now and a neighborhood resilience position.
But progress on clean energy in Tempe was hampered by resistance from utilities.
When I passed the 100% renewable energy goal for the city of Tempe, that was 2018, I thought, this is great, we're going to move rapidly. But honestly, we're only about at 18% now. We haven't moved very far, and that's because utilities don't have a strong signal that they need to act. I don't want my grandchildren to look back at me and say, you know, she didn't stand up and she didn't do much. I want them to know that I fought.
The Corporation Commission has five commissioners. Right now, there are two Democrats and three Republicans.
One of the Democrats, Anna Tovar, was elected 2 years ago. And Sandra Kennedy, who's on the commission now, is a warrior. She's the first Black woman elected statewide west of the Mississippi in the history of the United States. And she has been such a strong advocate for consumers. And because she is such a strong advocate and effective commissioner, in 2014, over $14 million was spent to defeat her in dark money. And she actually herself unearthed that figure by subpoenaing the utilities and requiring them to report what they spent on campaign.
One of the Republicans on the commission was the chief financial officer for Turning Point USA, a group that recruits high school and college students into the far right.
While a corporation commissioner, he reported working 50 hours a week as their chief financial officer while he was a full-time employee of the state of Arizona.
Turning Point spent $2 million on ads to promote Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court. And they sent buses of protesters to D.C. on January 6, including a guy who was indicted for throwing a fire extinguisher at police officers. That commissioner is leaving to run for state senator.
His policy aide is running in his place. And another person's running who has taken a lot of money from utility industry and was actually a utility lobbyist for 17 years.
The Corporation Commission sets statewide energy rules for utilities. Here's what Lauren wants to see.
100% renewable energy goal, rapidly decarbonize, funding of a just and equitable transition in a process of when coal plants are shut down, it's not a struggle each time. And I want to see an energy efficiency standard. It's not like the commission can order, go work with this city and that city and create larger solar installations. But if there's a 100% goal, they're going to need to do that. It will set a large signal that will really have to be followed.
20% of Arizona adults identify as independents, with the remainder evenly split between Republicans and Democrats.
But most people want the rules Lauren outlined.
There was a really robust poll at the Center for the Future of Arizona conducted, a nonpartisan group, and they found that 74% of Arizonans want to see a transition to clean energy. There's a great convening around environmental issues. It's just that our representatives have not done their job, and they've been very influenced by the utility industry and the fossil fuel industry.
So influenced that the Corporation Commission has been called the Corruption Commission.
Arizona's largest utility, the Arizona Public Service Company, secretly spent millions of dollars on political campaigns to influence Corporation Commission elections in 2014 and 2016. And in 2018, they spent tens of millions of dollars to defeat a clean energy ballot measure.
This year, they rejected a rule that would have required utilities to increase their percentage of renewable energy, which currently stands at 16%. And they let the state's energy efficiency standard expire without renewing it.
And that standard stopped us from having to build 15 power plants and saved us $9 billion. If you go for 100% renewables, you can easily get 25% of the way there with energy efficiency.
Lauren isn't taking donations from utilities or fossil fuel companies.
She could get support from the climate cabinet's PAC, but chose to run instead as a clean election candidate.
You get 2,000 people to give you $5, and then you qualify, and you get about $120,000 for the primary and then more for the general. And the beauty of that is I don't need to spend a lot of my time fundraising and making phone calls and going to events to raise money. I can actually talk to the voters.
There's plenty to talk about.
We're in a mega drought, the worst in 1,200 years. We also have issues on our tribal nations. There's 22 tribal nations in Arizona. We've been extracting from those tribal nations for years, and we've polluted their water, polluted their land. Over a third of the Navajo Nation does not have running water. And 70% of all the unelectrified homes in the country are in the Navajo Nation. These are people that have provided us the resources so we could grow our cities. So we've extracted the resources. The coal plants are shutting down as they should. They're not economically viable. But we haven't really established a just and equitable transition. I'm talking about that issue a lot in the campaign and hearing a lot about it from voters in northeastern Arizona. I'm all in on this because when Sandra and I win, we can change Arizona's energy future. You look at what happened with the SCOTUS decision yesterday. We're all reeling from it, and Congress is gridlocked. And we have to turn our attention to these statewide roles and the important role they play in advancing our clean energy economy.
State and local policymakers have a huge influence on our ability to solve climate change. We don't have to wait for Washington to fix itself in order to have big action on climate change today.
So ask not what the climate can do for you. And no, JFK did not hold me when I was a baby. But ask what you can do for the climate. Get pro-climate candidates on your school board for solar schools and electric buses, on your city council to eliminate parking requirements and zone for infill, in your legislature to set timetables for 100% clean energy and invest those Build Back Better funds in equitable climate action. And don't wait till election day.
Go volunteer now. The earlier you can get involved, the bigger impact you can have on the trajectory of the entire campaign.
And that goes double for money.
Early money is so, so much more effective. Listen, if it's 2 weeks before an election, you don't even know where your money's going at that point. Super early in the cycle, every dollar has the most impact. I think it's so important that we always find opportunities for hope. You know, a lot of our candidates, they're not trying to become the president of the United States. They're like, I'm going to do a great job for the people that I serve in the position that I have now. Pay is bad and they're not in the news all the time, but they're the folks who are doing the work that we need to build the clean energy future. That's so inspiring. That's my note of climate optimism today as the West Virginia versus EPA decision comes out.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. You've been listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
Thanks to Carolyn Spears, Lauren Kuby, and Nathaniel Stinnett, and to One Man Book, Jason Shaw, the U.S. Army Band, and Emma's Revolution for our music.
Gonna keep on moving forward. Keep on moving forward. Keep on moving forward. Never turning back. Never turning back. Sigamos adelante. Siempre adelante, siempre adelante, sin volver atrás, sin volver atrás. Gonna keep on moving forward,
keep on moving forward.